Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with novelist Wally Lamb, whose new book is the unforgettable We Are Water. Nonfiction writer Samuel G. Friedman turns his attention to Breaking the Line, the season in black college football that transformed the sport and changed the course of civil rights. I'll have a preview of the upcoming Louisiana Book Festival, and Latoya Devison of the New Orleans Public Library talks about the Tom Dent Literary Festival. A new novel from Wally Lamb is always a cause for rejoicing. His books, with the exception of The Charming Wishin' and Hopin', are very long and take years to write, and reading them can take days, though the time flies by when you're lost in one of his books. We know him from She's Come Undone, and I Know This Much Is True, Oprah Book Club Picks, and The Hour I First Believed. His most recent novel, just out, is We Are Water, a deeply satisfying look at a contemporary American family reeling under the weight of its own secrets. Wally Lamb, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Oh, it's great to talk to you again, Susan. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, I read that this book was inspired by a Patti Griffin song, so I went and listened to it, and I loved it, of course. So when you find these songs that take you into books, how does that work for you? Do you listen to them all the time? Do you play them while you're working or sing? Or I'm just curious.
I have different stories for different books as far as their association to music. With the case of We Are Water, my wife and I back in 2007 went down to New York to the Atlantic Theater Company, and they were premiering a musical based on Patti Griffin's songs. And I'm pretty well versed in Patti Griffin's material, but I did not know a song that they sang in that show called We Are Water. So I remember scrolling it down on the playbill, and for a couple of years I would say that every once in a while, We Are Water, what does that mean? I like the alliteration and so forth. And in the end, I wrote a novel to figure out for myself what that might mean.
Well, that took a while too, didn't it? 3 years.
It yeah, and then in 2009, I was doing a radio show, and it was in my hometown of Norwich, Connecticut. And the announcer said, "So, what's next for Wally Lamb?" I was out promoting Wishin' and Hopin', my little Christmas book, and I didn't want to appear to be as stupid as I could have appeared because I had no new plan. And so I just grabbed something out of the air. I said, "Well, maybe I'm going to write about the flood." And if you talk about the flood in Norwich, Connecticut, you mean the devastating 1963 flood. And so now I had the title, We Are Water, and I had just told myself I wanted to write about this flood that I remember vividly. So, the connections, the sparks began to fly, and the next thing you know, I was off and running with that story.
And these people in your book, these characters this time, some of them are based on actual people.
Yes. The flood that I was just referring to, it killed 5 different people. I remember it so vividly. I was about 12 years old that night, and I remember seeing the raging water, and I can still hear it roaring in my ears, and I can hear the screams of some of the victims. There was a factory, and third shift workers were buried alive when the factory collapsed. Anyway, the story that I remember most vividly was the story of 3 little boys whose parents had tried to outrun the water. And when that didn't happen, they managed somehow to get to a tree, and they were rescuing the boys. The father was up in the tree, and the mother was handing the kids up to him. Now, the little boys were 4 years old, 2 years old, and infant. And sadly, what happened was just when the infant got up in the tree, the water took the mother away, and she drowned. Now, there were news stories at the time, and I remember those vividly. And when I did that interview and I said, "Well, maybe I'll write about the flood," I was contacted by the cousin of those 3 little boys who are now grown men in their early 50s. So I was able to connect to them, and we walked the flood path one day, and they told me, the story of their lives. And what was really moving is that we found the tree from which they were rescued.
That must have been a moment.
It was a moment, for sure. Yeah. Oh. Very moving for me and for them, too. They call it the Tree of Life, and they've since put up a plaque there. And there was another person involved in the rescue then 19-year-old upstairs neighbor who was helping them and who was up in the tree holding on to the baby. And he was with us when we did that tour of the flood path.
Wow. Now, those are the people who are at the core of the family at the center of We Are Water. And this is a family that's kind of coming apart under the weight of secrets that have been kept for a long time. Could you tell us a little bit about the plot?
It opens in the aftermath of a divorce between two of the main characters, Orion Oh. He is half Chinese and half Italian, and he is a psychologist at a university. So he treats and counsels students at the university. And his wife, Annie Oh, is an outsider artist, and she has never had training in art, but she has started going on these scavenger hunts and is putting these assemblies together. And with the help of a gallery owner, she becomes quite successful, quite commercially viable. And she moves to New York and proceeds to fall in love with that gallery owner, who is a woman. And so as the story opens, the 27-year marriage between Annie and Orion is over. And Annie is in New York and planning to marry her partner, Vivica. So as the story unspools, we get into not only the reactions of those two, the ex-husband and ex-wife, but also their three grown children who are all in their 20s. You know, what are the repercussions? What are the reactions of kids whose mother decides to take this step?
And one of the other things that I love about this book is the way outsider art figures into it. I have to say, I love the angry art of Annie Oh. I could really sort of imagine it and see it in my mind's eye when she's looking at those wedding dresses. It was just such a moment, such a powerful moment. And there's this other outsider artist who haunts several of the characters through this book. And you base that character on the real artist Ellis Ruley, am I right?
I certainly did, Susan. I'm glad you brought that up. Ellis Ruley was a native of the same town that I grew up in, Norwich, Connecticut. And he was a painter. He was a laborer, but he began to paint obsessively. And he would create these canvases. Again, no training, a sort of distorted perspective, but wild with color. And these paintings sort of suggested story. I've been a big fan of Ellis Ruley's for a while now. He died in 1959. And never saw success in his own life. And then he died mysteriously. The coroner ruled that his death had been accidental. The black community, because he was an African-American artist, they were convinced that it was a racially motivated murder. Ellis had a white wife back in 1940s and 1950s Connecticut. A lot of people would not have been happy with that. And he also, because he had had a big insurance settlement, he had a big fancy car and he would drive around with his white wife. And
Wow. And
so I used Ellis Ruley as a model, a template for a character that I created named Josephus Jones, who may or may not be haunting a couple of characters, particularly Annie,
right. Who's
also an artist.
Now, this novel is about so much. It's about gay marriage, for starters. It's about how Annie's coming out affects her family. It's about child abuse and family secrets and changing dynamics and race, of course. These are dark, dark places you go to, Wally. And you seem like one of the happiest, nicest guys I've ever met. So it's like,
well, thank you for that.
So it's like, what is it like for you to dwell with these things for so long? Because,
well, you know, I have had a pretty unscathed life, and, you know, for that I'm really grateful. But I have worked for 14 years now with women in a Connecticut prison, like the only prison for women in Connecticut. So the women there live under maximum security rules. You know, I volunteer and teach a writing course there. And over those 14 years, I've taught a thing or two about writing to my students, and they have taught me so much about the kind of lives that I was spared. And what I'm talking about specifically was incest and the post-traumatic stress disorder that comes from these harrowing traumatic childhoods.
And we should also say that two volumes of their writing from the women of the York Correctional Institute have been published, Couldn't Keep It to Myself and I'll Fly Away.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a very special tie to New Orleans now, don't you, and have for quite a while.
Oh, I was hoping we were going to get there. yes, I have three sons, Jared, Justin, and Teddy, And Jared and Justin, the older two, are both residents of New Orleans. Jared began in Teach for America. He was posted there, and he evacuated during Katrina, came back as soon as he could, and he has been a principal of KIPP Charter School. And originally, he worked in the school in the French Quarter, and then more recently established a school called the New Orleans Leadership Academy.
And Justin is a poet.
He is a spoken word poet.
Yes.
And he is a member of Team Slam New Orleans, who I am very pleased to tell you won the national championship this past August up in Boston. And they are something. They're wonderful performers, the whole team. And Justin has been traveling with me, and he's my opening act. So he does his slam, and I'm starting to get a little envious because he really wins the crowd over, and then I have to get...
I have to follow that. That's okay.
Right, yeah. So I thought he was going to be my opening act, but as it turns out, it's more like, you know, I'm his closer.
Oh, that's tough.
He's a great kid, and it's so much fun.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we've been talking with Wally Lamb, whose great new book is We Are Water. You can meet him at Garden District Bookshop Friday, November 1st at 6, or see him at the Louisiana Book Festival Saturday, November 2nd at 2 p.m. and again at 3:15 p.m. in the Senate Chamber of the State Capitol in Baton Rouge. Thank you, Wally.
Oh, thank you, Susan.
'Cause we are water, we flow and flow. I feel you pour through every inch of my soul. And I really must tell you this before you go. We are water, we are water. We are water, we are water. We are water.
Samuel G. Friedman is a professor in the Columbia School of Journalism and the author of 7 books, including Up on This Rock, Small Victories, Who She Was, My Search for My Mother's Life, as well as Jew vs. Jew. His most recent book is Breaking the Line, The Season in Black College Football That Transformed the Sport and Changed the Course of Civil Rights. It's football season, after all, and this is the perfect book for a bye weekend. Sam Friedman, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Very happy to be with you, Susan. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, this is a book that's going to fascinate Louisiana sports fans because one of your main subjects is Coach Eddie Robinson of Grambling University.
That's right. The book is set in the 1967 football season, and it's really about a terrific on-the-field story as Grambling, coached by Eddie Robinson, and Florida A&M, coached by Jake Gaither, go through the season and get ready to play each other for the Black College Championship.
And they were after the same goals, but they were great rivals, weren't they?
I agree with you, Susan. I think Eddie Robinson and Jake Gaither were the two greatest coaches in Black college football and two of the greatest coaches in football, period. And added to the rivalries that their teams played in different leagues. So the only time they got to go head-to-head was for the Black college championship in a game called the Orange Blossom Classic. And these were men who wanted to win every game, who would use idioms like shoot a gnat with an elephant gun, run over a pig with a bus. So they're at the heat of competitive fire playing each other. But at the same time, they had tremendous mutual respect. They were two highly educated, principled, church-going men who, through football, were adamant about trying to contribute to the movement for racial equality, you know, trying to use football, which, of course, is so significant in the South, as a lever to break the hold of segregation and the cult of white supremacy.
Well, you make us feel the double bind that so many of these men felt, the coaches as well as the players. I mean, the players, for example, felt the need to be part of the resistance to the status quo, and yet they also felt that pull of being exemplary members of the community. And then for the coaches, they needed that access to white political leaders, but they were often accused of being Uncle Toms. So on all sides, it's kind of an essential story of manhood and dignity, don't you think?
What you say really gets to one of, I think, the key points in Breaking the Line and the key part of the world I write about, which is that these players and coaches did not live some separate, gilded existence. As Black Americans of a certain time and place, they were as affected by the inequalities of the society as anyone else. And the student athletes, they didn't live off in their own special athletic dorm. They lived in the dorms and joined the frats and went to classes with all the other students. And so they were deeply affected by the political currents of the time. And you had this generational divide, actually very similar to what's portrayed so heartbreakingly well in the film The Butler, of coaches Jake Gaither and Eddie Robinson, born in the early decades of the 20th century, you know, raised in a period when segregation seemed immutable, people who grew up amid horrible terroristic violence against black people, and who worked for state-controlled institutions. So they felt some constraints on being out there really publicly. And then you have their players, people who were 18, 19, 20 years old in 1967, who grew up in the era of Brown versus Board of Ed and the March on Washington and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And by 67, look around at the South during this era of massive resistance, as it was called, and see these promises aren't being kept, these laws aren't being implemented, and are losing patience with it, you know, the purely patient, nonviolent approach to civil rights. So on one hand, they revere and love and respect their coaches. They know that they owe their college educations to these coaches. They see Eddie Robinson and Jake Gaither as their role models. And on the other hand, they feel very drawn to not just Dr. King, but, you know, to Stokely Carmichael of SNCC at the dawning of the Black Power era, and to athletes like Jim Brown and Lew Alcindor, who would later become Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Muhammad Ali, athletes who, in a much more explicit way, were part of the movement and critical of the racial politics of America.
Now, sports stories, when they're told as well as this one is, are a fine canvas for revealing so much of history and human nature and personal heroism, but it's your first sports book. So was writing about this season, retelling all these games in detail, was that a challenge for you, or have you always been a frustrated sports writer?
I can't say I'm a frustrated sports writer, but I'm...
Not now, anyway.
I'm a lifelong football fan. There's no question about that. And I had always said to myself that I wanted at least one of my books to be about football. But I also wanted it to be about football and something larger than football itself, or football as an important part of American culture as it intersected with social issues or political issues. And in this case, you know, the civil rights story. So that did present me with a challenge because I felt that this book had to be as good a civil rights book as I could possibly write. It also had to be as good a football book as I could possibly write. And the challenge of the latter is that the mainstream media, which is to say at that time the white-owned media in the South, with a few exceptions, didn't really cover black colleges in any way, and certainly didn't cover their sports teams. And the excellent black newspapers around this country didn't have the resources to be sending a sports writer out to every major black game on every fall weekend. And so there was precious little detail that I could get even from the 1967 season, and I was just dogged enough and fortunate enough to eventually find copies of the game films of most of the games I wrote about, because you need that if you're going to go talk to coaches and players about why did you call this play or what happened on that play. You can't expect them to remember 40 years down the road a specific play. So what I was ultimately able to do was sit down with them and actually go through these ancient films with them.
That must have been just such fascinating talks. I mean, I can just imagine it. Now, Grambling is still in the news this week.
And this is really a case of Back to the Future. The Grambling football team boycotted some practices and then ultimately boycotted a game last weekend against Jackson State. And this was so parallel to an incident I wrote about in Breaking the Line. During the 1967 season, student protesters at Grambling, in fact, led by someone who a lot of people in New Orleans know, Willie Zanders, an attorney who's represented a lot of the summarily fired black educators in New Orleans, those protesters used the homecoming game and the homecoming weekend at Grambling to draw attention with their protests to, at that time, the racial inequalities in higher ed funding. They knew that the one time you might get some attention at Grambling would be on a football weekend, and they tried to leverage that to raise their issues of racial inequality, and they really sacrificed for it. Willie Zanders was one of 30-plus students to be expelled as a result. And what you had at Grambling last week were the football players raising issues that, putting aside the issue of their head coach, Doug Williams, having been fired during the season, the other issues, the conditions of their facilities, the fact that they had to take bus trips to games, more than 1,200, 1,500-mile round trips, those issues are the athletic department's part of an overall financial crisis at Grambling, which is related to a lot of statewide funding decisions in Louisiana and is related in a different way to the fact that black colleges educating students who are the first in their families to go to school who don't come from wealthy families, black colleges can't generate the endowments that other, you know, historically white, as we might call them, colleges can, that help them ride out periods of, you know, financial struggle. Grambling has an endowment of $5 million. LSU has an endowment of $437 million. And, I mean, that's really good for LSU. I'm glad that they have those resources. But schools that don't have them, when their state aid gets cut, are in dire situations. And the Grambling football team was able to leverage the visibility they have because of Grambling's great football legacy to draw attention to a much bigger issue than sports alone. And what I've said about it is whatever their one lost record ends up being this season, by raising this issue and maybe helping to rectify it, they've had a championship season.
Oh, that's great. Well, this is a marvelous book. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Sam Friedman, who's the author of Breaking the Line, The Season in Black College Football That Transformed the Sport and Changed the Course of Civil Rights. You can meet him Tuesday, October 29th at 7 in the Kendall Cram Room of the Lavin Burnick Center at Tulane, or Wednesday, October 30th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thank you so much.
Susan, it was my complete pleasure and honor. Thanks for having me.
One of the special events coming up soon is the annual Tom Dent Literary Festival. It takes place Friday, November 1st at the Main Library downtown and at Dillard University. Here to talk with us about it is Latoya Devison, a library associate with the New Orleans Public Library's African American Resource Center. She plans this festival. Welcome to The Reading Life, Latoya.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about Tom Dent and why we celebrate his life every year.
Tom Dent was a poet, essayist, oral historian, cultural activist, and noted figure in the Black arts movement. And we celebrate his life every year because New Orleans was his hometown, and he was such an integral part of what made up the writers' movement in New Orleans.
And so he loved New Orleans,
And he loved New Orleans. So once he came back, after he returned from college, he didn't leave. And so who better to celebrate than Tom Dent?
Right. And of course, it's natural to have it at Dillard and at the Main Library, isn't it?
Yes.
So what's on tap for this year?
On tap for this year, we have the children's program that morning at 10:30, and we also have a teen program in the morning at 10:30 at the same time.
And those are at the library, right?
Yes. The children's program is in the African American Resource Center. We have storytelling and Aesop's fables from an Afrocentric perspective. And then with the teen program, we have Chukwuma Chajuwa is performing a one-man show called Has Anybody Here Heard of Langston Hughes?
That's going to be great, don't you
think? I think so, too.
And then what takes place that evening?
That evening, we have a spoken word program. And also, this year, we have a new addition. We have hip-hop violinist Trenton Thomas.
Nice.
And he will be opening the program. We're going to have students from Dillard and Dr. Mona Lisa Saloy. They're going to be our MCs. And then we're going to have Asia Rainey, Clarence Zero Skidmore, and Chris One Eye Williams are going to be our spoken word artists for the evening.
So what are the challenges of putting this together every year for you?
The most difficult challenge is a shoestring budget, believe it or not, because we put it together on bubblegum, pretty much. But other than that, it's just a matter of getting everyone coordinated, hearing back from everyone, making sure everyone shows up, making sure we have everything in place. And so usually the last 2 weeks of October, I'm running around the library like a hurricane. You'll probably see a whirl, and that's me.
He meant so much to so many people that I think a lot of people are inclined to be generous and to want this to go on and make it happen, don't you find?
I think so, too, particularly his mentees. We've had great support from Kalamu Yasalam over the years and Chukwuma Chajuwa.
Well, it's hard work to put on a festival, and I hope everybody appreciates everything you're doing. So we've been talking with Latoya Devison, who's a library associate with the New Orleans Public Library's African American Resource Center. She plans the Tom Dent Literary Festival, which takes place this year on November 1st. Thanks so much, Latoya.
Thank you.
For more information about the Tom Dent Literary Festival, check out neworleanspubliclibrary.org or call 504-596-2597. Thank you. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Chef John Besh signs Cooking from the Heart, Lessons Learned Along the Way, Tuesday, October 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Southern Food and Beverage Museum Culinary Library opens to the public Wednesday, October 30th from 2 to 4 at SOFAB, 1609 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. Monique Moliere Piper signs Dancing in the Sun, Being the Authentic You, Wednesday, October 30th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Sam Friedman, discusses and signs Breaking the Line, the season in black college football that transformed the sport and changed the course of civil rights, Wednesday, October 30th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Lorraine Johnston signs Later Tartan Gator, A New Orleans Tale, Wednesday, October 30th at 6 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Author, illustrator, and Oscar winner for the fantastic flying books of Mr. Morris Lesmore, that's William Joyce. He'll sign The Mischievians, Friday, November 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Wally Lamb, signs We Are Water, Friday, November 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Bragg appears Sunday, November 3rd at 3:30 at Loyola University's Neunemaker Auditorium. Marty Muley signs Game Changers, The Rousing Legacy of Louisiana Sports, Monday, November 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. George Bishop, whose new novel is The Night of the Comet, will be the 1718 Society's featured reader, Tuesday, November 5th at 7 at the Collins Hotel, 3811 St. Charles Avenue. And coming up this weekend, there's a lot of action. The Tom Dent Literary Festival takes place Friday, November 1st at the New Orleans Public Library and Dillard University. Chakula Chajua presents a one-man show based on Tom Dent's life and work at the main library at 10:30 Friday morning. And then Mona Lisa Saloy and her students present a discussion about the importance of Dent's life from 5:30 to 7:30 in the Professional Building Auditorium at Dillard University. The Louisiana Book Festival takes place all day Saturday, November 2nd, on the grounds of the Louisiana State Capitol in Baton Rouge. Among the authors appearing this year are Christine Wiltz, who will be receiving the Louisiana Writer Award. Also on hand will be former winners Ernest Gaines, William Joyce, Shirley Ann Grau, Tim Gautreaux, and John Biganay. Other writers to appear include George Bishop, Rick Bragg, Beth Ann Fennelly and Tom Franklin, Peggy and Errol Laborde, Wendy Rodrigue, as well as State Poet Laureate Ava Lavelle Heyman and former laureates Daryl Bork and Julie Kane. Best of all, it's free, with food and music and events all over the Capitol grounds. Don't miss it. Check out LouisianaBookFestival.org for more information. And coming up, the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans is presenting The Art of the Book, a repurposed literary challenge, Saturday, November 16th from 7 to 9 at the new G&O Food Company, 935 Gravier Street. All submissions will be auctioned to support projects of the local chapter, supporting literacy initiatives, author discussions, and other events. You can do your book art in several categories: traditional, an art book, decorative items, wearable art and accessories or clothing, and entries will be accepted until November 8th. Submissions must be turned in by November 15th. For more information and to download an entry form, check out the website artofthebooknola.wordpress.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.